Hey everybody, this is Queen James. Welcome to episode 97 of the Linear Reread. Just wanted to let you know I ended up having to split this episode up into two parts. So go ahead and look out for part one and part two, just because of the length of the episode. Part one will contain the first two chapters, a Tyrion and a Dany chapter, and then part two will have a Dany chapter and a TWoW preview chapter of Arianne's. And we also go into a quite lengthy show discussion at the end. So go ahead and look out for parts one and part two, and enjoy.
Novagiri! Axiosentas! Mentiosentas! Kiloni filos levale tolviosentas! Ininio trigatas! Urnei luei tolidei prisotas!
Hello everybody and welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave, a great linear A Song of Ice and Fire reread. We are on episode 97. This episode could potentially spoil any events in George R.R. Martin's published series, including TWoW preview chapters. It will not, however, contain show spoilers unless clearly marked before. In this last episode, we ended with Jon learning that the Karstarks are about to betray Stannis in Jon 9. And in this episode, we will cover Tyrion 10, Dany 8, Dany 9 from Dance, and we will also go over an Arianne chapter from TWoW. These events cover July 1st through July 3rd of 300 AL. And today I am joined by Sarah.
Hi, it's Sarah, Dr. Blood on the forums.
Michael.
Hey, Carl Wadeggi on the forums.
Kevin.
Hey, this is Kevin, also known as Gaiden on the forums.
Noah.
Hey, Pops88 on the forums.
Marie.
Hey everyone, it's Nymeria on the forums.
Matt.
Barley on the forums.
And the lovely Bina.
Yo, 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 Bina007 on the forums.
And we may be joined by Hannah sometime later, she just has not joined the party yet. So I think we might as well go ahead and get started with our first chapter. So with Tyrion 10, we have Sarah.
All right. Tyrion 10 begins with Tyrion and Penny on the slave auction block in the Yunkish camp outside Meereen. Among their most interested bidders are an old woman, an enormously obese man in yellow, and, as the prices rise higher, a sellsword with weathered brown skin who seems to recognize Tyrion. Trying to avoid becoming the property of Lord Yellowbelly, Tyrion provokes the crowd to laughter by bidding on himself, dropping hints about his true identity to further pique the sellsword's interest. His efforts fail, however, and he and Penny, and the dog and pig included, are sold to Yezin Zokagaz, oh my god, a kind and benevolent master, who will include Yolo and Penny among his special treasures, as they are told by the Yellow Whale's overseer called Nurse. As they prepare to leave the auction site, Tyrion recognizes Jorah Mormont, bruised, bloodied, and nearly unrecognizable for the violence he has suffered at the hands of the slavers, as next on the auction block. After hearing from Nurse that Mormont is likely to be bought by the old woman as a poorly maintained and quickly dispatched pit fighter, Tyrion convinces the overseer that Mormont plays the bear to Penny's maiden fair in another of their comedic routines. Nurse informs Yezin, and Mormont is purchased and loaded onto the cart with Penny, Yolo, Crunch, and Pretty Pig. Tyrion observes that Mormont appears broken, more beast than man, and devastated by the news of Daenerys' marriage. As they travel from the slave market to Yezin's tents, Tyrion observes, quote, everyone and everything in the Yunkish camp, including the brutal corporeal punishments to which slaves are subjected, and the six trebuchets the Yunkish army has constructed. He also observes signs of the flux throughout the camp and recalls his father's warning that disease can destroy an army more easily than battle. Arriving at Yezin's enormous camp estate, Tyrion and Penny meet the other treasures, members of what Tyrion quickly recognizes as the Master's grotesquerie. Chief among them is a learned and beautiful hermaphrodite called Sweets, who cautions Tyrion that the overseer nurse is the only true monster here. After baths and grooming, Tyrion and Penny are set to entertain the guests at Yezin's feast, among whom are the Yunkish Supreme Commander, the Tattered Prince of the Windblown, and Brown Ben Plum, the mystery bidder at Tyrion's auction. The guests are pleased by the show, after which Tyrion and Penny pour water and wine, work, Tyrion observes, that is, quote, harder than it appeared. Yezin then allows Tyrion to play Syvas, first against the Yunkish lord who challenges him and loses, and then several games against Brown Ben Plum, all but one of which Tyrion also wins, along with a large amount of gold for his master. As a reward for the excellent service they have provided that evening, Nurse informs Tyrion and Penny that they will have the honor of jousting in the Great Pit of Dasnak in Meereen at the celebratory reopening of the fighting pits. The end.
Thank you for that. Beautiful. All right. So does anybody have any thoughts before, like, anything you want to say before I start asking any questions, or?
Who cares?
Right. Oh my God. Yeah, this was.
I kind of do. And I think I did, especially when I read this for the first time.
It did make me chuckle when you couldn't pronounce that guy's name, because I've struggled with every fucking Yunkish lord.
Well, and the thing about that is I really don't care about their names. I just, like, spot them. You know, I don't care how to pronounce it. I don't care what it looks like. I just know that it's, like, the Y with the double Z in the middle. Okay,
I have that guy. Yeah, I do that, too. They're basically just noise, but I recognize the sight rather than the sight, yeah.
Right, exactly.
And then he just gave up when he got to nurse.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I think, like, in one of the chapters, Quentin's buddies are like, oh, they're all called his Lou or something, you know, like, it doesn't matter. But, I mean, honestly, like, we get it. The system is fucked up and people are oppressed and, like, I don't understand why we have to see, like, every little microcosm of this.
Well, so one of the interesting things that I noticed at the beginning of the chapter is the way that Tyrion talks about how the sailors have the binder and the five fingers are temple slaves. And so they know exactly, there's a certainty that they're not going to be, like, rescued necessarily, but they know exactly what's going to happen to them. And he sees that as, like, a sense of security or a sense almost of luxury, whereas he and Penny are completely, like, you know, up to fate. And I thought that was an interesting, like, recognition on some level of the kinds of information that Dany is getting about the people who want to sell themselves back into slavery, where there actually is, like, a comfort to it. And I'm not, you know, I'm not, like, pro-slavery, so I don't want to, but, it was just an interesting kind of insight on his part that, like, there is actually a kind of horrible security that comes along with it, in addition to these grotesque oppressions and, you know, physical maltreatments and things like that, that he also witnesses.
I think the ones who have signed with the widow, it mentions, like, the shipmates, they're freemen. So the contract they have specifically gives them a ransom so that they don't become slaves. But, like, the Red Fingers are naturally slaves to R'hllor, so they belong somewhere else.
Okay, I think you're right.
Yeah, no, I think you are too, but I think he characterizes it in such a way that it basically sounds like...
It lets them be blasé about the slavery. They're like, no, I'm fine.
But they kind of have to sign themselves away in order to get that. I said none of the seasoned seamen were a valuable commodity. None had put up any sort of fight when the slavers boarded their crippled cog. For them, this was just a change of owner. The ship's mates had been freemen, but the widow of the, yeah. So, like, yeah, you're right. It is a distinction, but it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's
the only comment I have on this chapter my notes that I'd written in the show notes were zero the fucks they give about this chapter. However, I did find the description of Lord Yellowbelly actually quite offensive to heavy people, of which I am one. And just all the writing, the way the writing is about the quote-unquote Far East is mm-hmm. problematic. Normally, I just don't notice mm-hmm. it, but it really, together with that description of the fat guy, really pissed me off. And I just thought it was kind of interesting, given that George is himself kind of heavy. And I mean, maybe he's making a point about how he feels people would be in savage cultures that are slave owning, or just cynicism about how life is and how people think about fat people. But I don't know, for whatever reason, this chapter really got to me, and it hasn't previously. So maybe it's just the combination.
I think there's a difference between like the like fat and what Yezin is. I imagine Yezin's like, you know, the type of person that they have to like break down the wall to get him out of his house. Like eventually, they're just so enormous.
But even then, I don't know.
Yeah, but maybe, like,
the way Tyrion refers to him as like a whale and an enormity and stuff. It's like fat based language.
Isn't yellow whale his
people like that?
His moniker. That I mean, like it's a. It's his nickname. I mean, I think it's
Tyrion's nickname for him. I'm not sure if it's his actual nickname.
Yeah, I can't imagine that it is. Probably, yeah.
I do think it is interesting with George. This is one of the areas, like, you have Wyman Manderly and my famous quote saying, "I am fat and many think that makes me foolish." But then he also indulges in, I guess you could call it fat stereotypes, and I guess discrimination that fat people face. The way Tyrion also insults Illyrio, and the way Varys is treated. It actually reminds me of the way he treats little people. So obviously you have Tyrion in this chapter, and the exploration of Tyrion as a character as a little person. But then you also have the other side where those little dwarfs are the servants in the House of the Undying, and they've got like blue lips and a snout. And yeah, so George is, I feel like he's having his cake and eating it as well.
Is that a fat joke?
Oh, no. No, Matt, I would be more sensitive than that.
What also troubles me with this is that it's not even really realistic, because we've already got a description of like Illyrio as the fattest person there could be. And then we meet this guy who's supposedly like four times what Illyrio is supposed to be. And it's a bit like it's too much. It's just an exaggeration. Ah, come on. That's just. It makes it really a bit ridiculous, I think.
Well, I mean, I think that to kind of build on what Bina was saying, like what people have characterized as the orientalization of a socioculture, I think that there's a lot of that here. I think also the tendency that George displays in writing is to accentuate the excess, like that they eat everything that swims or flies, I think it says in one of the other chapters, and you know, that all of the smells are more smelly and all of the noises are noisier. And I mean, it's just it brings a vividness to it, but it's a vividness that's characterized by just grotesque excess in every sensory respect. And I do think that that's very problematic in a lot of the ways that he goes about doing it, because that excess is ultimately leveled on or sort of layered on or placed on certain individual characters as like personifying it, which becomes much less a world building and much more like, you know, offensive caricatures of any given like individual in the narrative.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of the main stereotypes of Orientalism is that it's a culture of excesses.
Yeah.
Well, then getting into when they were talking about all, like you said, they'll eat anything, pretty much. The most upsetting thing to me about the whole chapter was that they eat puppies on a stick. Did you guys read that part?
Yeah, that was the Danny Pitt chapter. That's like their...
Oh, was their... that? Okay, I thought it might be this one when they were...
No, it's like puppies dipped in honey or something.
Didn't mention unborn puppies.
Yeah. Unborn puppies.
It's terrible.
Yeah. That was like the most upsetting thing to me about this entire chapter. Not anything about being bought into slavery, but the unborn puppy eating.
It gives a new meaning to corn dog, doesn't it?
Oh, no. Oh, my God. So, of course, I think I've mentioned this in previous rereads, but it's something that I, like, cling on to. Does anybody else find it funny or confusing that Tyrion is, like, one of the only people, like, he doesn't get sick with much of anything. He didn't get grayscale when he fell into the river.
Because he's a Targaryen?
Yes. See, that's what... Are we, like... Is it being laid on that thick that, like, he is a Targaryen? He can't get sick?
I feel like it's more like he's an Arthur avatar. He's just George R. R. Martin in the world, so he can't die or get hurt too bad.
The plot has uses for him yet, so he can't die of sniffles.
I guess. It's just... I think I read this, like, a couple years ago, and of course, that's, like, one of the things that I've held on to. I don't want Tyrion to be a Targaryen, but I think that's one of, like, the bigger, red flags that he possibly is.
But only recently, right? Like that, not until Fire and Blood was that made.
A Dance with Dragons is when it is first. Danny just brings it up. Have you ever known a dragon to get sick? Okay. But I really just think it's an artifact of Tyrion being a main character in this story, and he's clearly meant to survive till somewhere in the end game.
Yeah, because what I found just so like ridiculous is that he's mouthing off to the, like, he's a slave now. You're a slave. You're in the hands of other people. And he just won't shut up. And I figure that other characters, they would get their tongue torn out. But Tyrion just keeps on trucking.
Yeah.
Good old plot armor.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that's necessarily plot armor. Because, like, he does get whipped for every time he speaks out. And Yezen obviously has a soft spot for these grotesqueries. So in this specific case, I would say it's fine.
Which, so now also, speaking of that, like how Yezen values what does he call them? Like his favorite ones?
Treasures, his special treasures.
Yeah, I know it's not until Danny 9 that they show what happens in the pit, but do you think, was Yezen aware that they were going to release lions on his like favorite little things, or... Like, do you think that he set that up? Was that part of, like...
No, I think Nurse is just a dick.
When Yerkaz is telling Yezen, he whispers something in his ear, and he laughs, but Tyrion also sees, like, his eyes tighten up or something. And so I think he doesn't want this to happen, but he knows he can't say no to Supreme Commander Guy.
Yeah, I think that's exactly when it happens, too.
Okay. Thank you for that. I didn't get that, so... anybody else have any other points on this chapter?
I like the description of Brown Ben Plum in this chapter. There's Tyrion's like, oh, he smiles, but his eyes don't smile. And then he describes him when playing Savase. He's a man who plays like he doesn't want to lose. I mean, it says something about who he is and how he's going to make his deals.
Yeah, he doesn't play to win. He plays not to lose. That's exactly what I was going to say. I wanted to point out something that, I mean, we've talked before in other rereads about how putting the chapters together chronologically pulls out themes and motifs that we wouldn't necessarily have noticed individually. And I thought for this group of chapters, at least the dance chapters, that there was a very interesting repetition of the senses and like sensory input, but also of like eating and meat specifically in different iterations. So I just kind of wanted us to keep an eye out for that. I think it starts with the descriptions of the camp as Tyrion is traveling through it. And on one hand, like the slave bodies that he sees being converted from functioning people into like meat and tendons. But then also like people preparing their dinners and the feast that they're serving and things like that. But it comes back obviously in Dany's feast and then also in the representations of the pit. So yeah, I just wanted to point that out.
Good point. Can be taken positively and negatively. In terms of, is he doing this deliberately to contrast with what we've left behind in King's Landing, especially in the north, which is starvation and deprivation? Or is it just another signal he has of the luxuriance and opulence of the Orient?
Oh, also, Yezin is sick because he traveled to Sotheros, which I thought that was really interesting. Which I thought was really interesting. Because I feel like he has some kind of like mystery backstory, the way that Illyrio does, where like he used to be, you know, this lithe water dancer or whatever. But I feel like Yezin, it hints that he was like a traveler or an explorer or something. And
it was like an STD.
No, it says he traveled to Sotheros. And he's since then he's been rotting from the inside, is what they say.
Yeah, that's. I kind of got that it was some kind of like wasting illness or something like that that he picked up.
That place is dangerous, though. Just avoid it.
It sounds horrible. Yeah, like the sweating sickness, and then the flesh falls off of your skin, and the
yeah. They had a bit in Fire and Blood, didn't they? And it was just awful.
Yeah, he says, Sweets is telling them, 10 years ago he went to Sotheros, and he's been rotting from the inside out ever since. Make him forget that he is dying, even for a little while, and he can be most generous. But I would love to have, like, a travelogue of Yezin's journey to like the new Lomas Longstrider or something. Like,
well, it sounds like a little bit like hepatitis, because isn't he all yellow, too, like jaundice? Maybe his liver just stopped functioning.
Oh, maybe. Yeah.
His blood isn't being filtered, and so all the impurities are just making him rot.
Right, and that's why his belly's so big. He's all liver.
He's got cirrhosis.
Yep.
So he went to Sotheros and just drank a ton.
What an anticlimax.
Yeah.
So are any of the people at the auction important at all? Or I think we see one of the generals is a young woman who is mimicking herself as another Daenerys.
Yeah, I was going to actually bring up, do we know who the old woman is who always bids $1 more than everyone else?
That's even cool
at The Price is Right.
She's an asshole from The Price is Right.
But she does pop up later in a Quentin chapter. They go to her bar and they meet the tattered prince again. So not ultimately important, but she's around.
And one. What a bitch.
Yeah. Okay. So then after Tyrion 10, we jump forward two chapters to Dany 8. This takes place the next day on July 2nd, and with our chapter summary, we have Michael.
All right. So the halls ring with Yunkish laughter, and Daenerys is pissed off. A feast is being held to celebrate the brokered peace between Meereen and Yunkai. Dany feels insulted by the slave performances on display. To make matters worse, the Yunkish have erected a slave market outside of Meereen. Tomorrow, Dany's new husband, Hizdar, will open the fighting pits as part of the terms of peace. 3 Yunkish nobles and 4 sellsword captains have been admitted into Meereen, exchanged for 7 of Dany's men, including Daario, Hizdar's sisters and cousins, as well as her sea admiral, Lord Grolio. Dany's former captain of the Brazen Beasts, Skahaz Mokhandak, has been replaced by another of Hizdar's cousins and is absent for the feast. Daenerys comes into contact with Brown Ben Plum, who tells her that he bears no hard feelings over the defection, but Brown Ben Plum fights for the winning side, saying that life is more important than gold. Daenerys discusses with Barristan whether Ben could be replaced as mercenary captain should the peace break, and tells him to return Pretty Mirrus, who was imprisoned after Quentin's revelation, to the Tattered Prince as a means of establishing a connection between the two. Dany meets with Quentin once more and takes him down to the Dragon Pit. She tells him that although she cannot marry him, there is still a chance for an alliance between Daenerys and Dorne, but advises Quentin to leave Meereen for his safety, to which Quentin refuses. She returns to a drunk Hizdar and passionlessly consummates the marriage with him. Missandei hears her crying later that night, and Danny asks her to stay and talk about Narth and the things that make her happy. So this is a kind of sad chapter, or it ends on a very sad note.
Yeah, downer.
There's elements of, anger, regret, sadness. Daenerys is very much not happy with what she's done.
If she looks back, she is lost.
Yeah.
What is up with Missandei? Seriously. She is so creepy. I don't think she's a faceless man, but there is something seriously wrong with that kid. Because, Dany wasn't crying, right? Can we...
Oh, yes, she was. Daenerys is she's in denial. Because she says, why would I be crying? I have everything I want. I have my peace. I have my husband. I have all these things. That's, clearly a show, a performance.
But it's so weird that it doesn't tell us from her perspective that she was crying. It's that she's tossed and turning, and that she's, she can't sleep. And, I can see where she would be, but... Then she, she seems just as surprised by, I don't know, I don't think she was, and I think Missandei is insane.
I view this as unreliable narrator.
And yeah, that's what I saw it as.
She doesn't want the reader to know she's crying.
I think this is the first time I've ever heard Missandei hate come out.
I don't hate her, she just freaks me out.
Because she's being kind and comforting in Daenerys' time of need?
She's
uncannily perceptive for an 11-year-old. I think that might be it. She's always pointing things out that adults miss and stuff.
She's not the child out of The Shining, though, or one of the twins.
I think that's kind of how I picture her. Yeah, that may be the... Because she also hears the scratching in the wall. She's like, I can't sleep because there's scratching in the walls and I guess she hears the dragon. I don't know. There's a theory that she's a faceless person.
And they're all fucking creepy.
Who is?
Hi, Hannah.
Hi.
Everyone's Narth. That whole island is creepy. The psycho killer butterflies and shit.
Killer butterflies, yeah.
These killer butterflies.
I don't know. There's a theory out there that she's a faceless man, which I don't buy into, but the arguments for that lay out all of the creepy shit that she does, and I'm totally there for that. She's just, I don't know, there's something about her that just makes me very uncomfortable.
And I also,
but I don't hate her.
I guess
she's a child.
Just to support your argument, not necessarily that I fully believe it, but what did having Missandei come in at the end of the chapter add to the narrative besides just having this girl come in and say that? Was there any... She doesn't add anything to the chapter, I don't think.
Oh, absolutely. She lets us know that Daenerys is crying.
I think, but we already know how upset Daenerys is. So you think just because she said, you're crying, and that was her whole
she,
point?
And Dany asks her to stay and say nice things about Narth and stuff that she likes. She's absolutely there just for getting Daenerys to express some more emotions for the reader to pick up on.
How about was this chapter, right? When Quentin is trying to keep his shit together and it reminded me of coming home drunk in front of your mom and just being no, everything is fine. Trust me. He's standing there wasted. Right? That's this chapter, right?
Yeah, when she takes him down to see the dragons.
Okay, because I was I listened to, or I did everything all at once, so I was did I blend those two together? But, yeah, and I listened to it on the audiobook, and Roy Dotrice's version of a drunk person is kind of funny, too.
The best narrator.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that we start to see a little bit more from Dany, or more than we've seen recently from her in terms of affinity with the dragons in this chapter. She's been very disconnected from them at least since she locked them away, and I would argue even a little bit before that. but when the dragon roars, it says that she's flushed with a sudden heat. And she starts really thinking about herself as her mother, as their mother, and tells Quentin that she's fire and blood, and that she's, you know, one of them, and she's a dragon. And I don't know. I think it's an interesting, like, groundwork for the very physical sensations that she experiences with Drogon. And I think, like, as much as she talks about herself as their mother, there's like an erotic element to it too, in her physical reactions to them. And I don't know what to do with that necessarily, but I thought it was interesting.
Just that she feels flushed,
or yeah, but like that she's,
she's about, I didn't get the erotic much part. More.
It gets worse when she rides away on him. It gets real worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the part that seems very sexual.
But I mean, this, like, I think it's like a compound effect for me, but like this, the sudden flush, I don't know. It's just like an excitement that I don't think is fear, and I'm not sure. It just suggests that there's like an affinity between them that we haven't seen in evidence in the narration, like for a lot of the time up until this point. Like she's been sort of overridden by her Myrinese self-image and self-characterization. Yeah.
Well,
she's starting to get back into like the dragons.
Yeah, exactly. I completely agree with you. And I think it's quite straightforward, actually. We see that in the next chapter, she's gonna be with Drogon, and she's lost herself into Meereen for a while, and right now we start to hear about the dragons again and actually go see them, and I think that's meaningful. She's on her way back to Westeros, finally, in a very converted way.
Yeah,
and that goes with Quentin arriving as well. Like she gets hints of Westeros, and she is not happy in Meereen. She doesn't exactly regret what she's done, but she's really not happy with it. And it all goes to show that she's going to leave soon.
So I thought there was an interesting subconscious aspect with Dany in this chapter. So on one hand, she's talking to Barristan. It's like, we need to be prepared if the peace breaks. We need to see if we can get these mercenary companies on their side. But on the other hand, it also feels like she is trying to destabilize the peace that she's just made because she hates it so much. And then when she takes Quentin down to the dragon pit, one interpretation is that she's subconsciously saying to Quentin, ride one of these dragons, set me free, and, you know, destroy all this crap that I don't like. You know, give me a third option. Obviously, she's not aware of this, but I think there's some subconscious desire to break this peace that's raging within her.
Fire and blood, baby. We all know how it ends with Quentin, though.
That's Quentin's beginning, okay?
No, we don't.
Quentin,
oh, come on.
I'm not saying he lives. I'm just saying it's not proven.
Yeah, guys, Dina's on the episode. Quentin's alive.
Okay. I'm actually, this is a good point to say, just to interrupt for a minute. I'm going to have to go because just been WhatsApp to say that family is arriving soon unexpectedly, but in a classically Indian, slightly annoying way. So I need to go do some cooking. But it's been a joy. My contributions have been minor, so you won't miss me. And I will listen to the final product. Bye, everyone.
Beautiful.
Bye, Bina. Bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye, Bina.
Yeah, thank you for your wonderful card. I love you all. You sent me a lovely Christmas card. And I felt so honored.
Oh. Very nice.
She just is very nice. Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry I was late. I didn't sleep very well, and I have only had like 2 days off in the last month, and I just needed the extras.
It's all good. I'm glad you made it.
All right.
So we were talking about the Danny chapter. Does anybody else have anything on this one before we move on to what I think is probably the biggest chapter of the episode?
Besides that Miss Andy is a monster? No, I'm good.
Devil child.
Yeah. Oh my god.
I like Brown Ben Plum's story that he gives about how he found the gold and then he told someone about it and then he got snitched on and he lost the gold. Like, that's very relatable. And I can imagine that set. Oh, he could have been rich. And one of his friends was like a weasel. And like, I can imagine that very much set him in his mind of being overly cautious and cynical and just being the way he is. I just liked it.
I'm sorry.
I feel like it's a bit too easy.
What was that, Hannah?
Yeah, say that again.
Did you say one of his friends is a weasel?
Yeah,
I love that. Yeah.
True that.
I like that he got to keep the coat, though, and that he said that. He was like, well, I got to keep the coat, so, you know.
Sorry. I mean, I know we already know more of him than this story, but I think it's a bit too easy to just be like, so this happened to me, so now I'm treacherous and unloyal, and yeah, it's a bit too easy.
Well, yeah, in like two chapters' time, he's like, we were always Daenerys' men. What the fuck are we talking
about? Yeah.
Yeah,
it's just
he can see the way the wind is blowing. He knows when to switch sides.
The winds of winter, if you will.
He's like who is the word, the Stanleys in the Wars of the Roses, right? Like, we'll just see how this goes. You know, with Henry the VII.
I don't know much about that, but I'm sure somebody does.
Well. Being
I should,
joke
I
for
should
sure.
know, but no, I don't know.
Like, that's actually your country, Noah.
I read the Wikipedia once.
He musters an army, and then when Richard of York meets Henry the VII on the Battle of Bosworth Field, he like literally waits to engage. He stands there and waits to see how it'll turn out before he casts his lobby.
About the Kingmaker, are you, Hannah? Because he switches.
No, that's Warwick. Warwick is his title, but no, this guy. I think he was married to Margaret Beaufort. Like, they were brothers. It was two.
Is he in Shakespeare? Because if he wasn't, I don't know that one.
They would always have. They were like two brothers, and they would like fight on both sides of the battle. So like, one of them would always win.
That's, you know,
brilliant. And then homeboy at this last one was like, we'll just see how this turns out. And then I always find it really weird because he like waits until Henry the VII is actually almost about to get clobbered and then joins him. It's really weird. And then that's how Henry Tudor became King of England.
He sounds like Walder Frey, this person.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I guess they both have a little bit of that going on. It's smart. I mean, you can't blame them, really.
Is his sigil a weather vane? Wait, that's another character that Jamie tells that joke to.
Yeah, Swan.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Bina's going to be just screaming her head off when she's listening to this podcast.
I think a lot of people.
Right, exactly.
No, I'm sure I'm right. And then Henry the VII. Later, like, rewrote history, and instead of calling him the late King Richard the Third or whatever he was, just called him the former Duke of Gloucester instead.
No, I think Venus going to be screaming at this because none of us know what you're talking about. Except
I know,
for you.
Vina. I've been sorry, watching Vina. Documentaries, kid. I got you, girl.
Nice. Beautiful.
So, the scratching at the walls, is that anything? Is that just mice in the wall? Or is that actually people like Missandei thinks? And
well, do you reckon they
the dragons?
That was the interpretation was the dragons, we agreed on when we did the thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's the dragons, and even Dany says that she can tell that they're kind of taking away parts of the pyramid, right? They're like kind of burrowing through, and she wonders if they're like the fireworms of old Valyria.
Yeah, Viserion has definitely made a hole in the ceiling to, I guess, to get away from Rhaegal.
Yeah, but I thought it was the Astapori that they thought were chiseling through the walls or something.
There's that, too. I was thinking about that as well.
Maybe a little bit.
Do you not think they maybe built the pyramids like the Red Keep, you know, with shitloads of passageways and hidden air ducts where kids can eavesdrop and shit?
Well, that's how Missandei sneaks up on Ser Barristan, as I'm reading Sarah's crazy fucking theory.
Completely unfounded theory here, but what if the Astapori...
I do not stand behind the faceless man thing. I just will go as far as it's a list of creepy shit that she does, and it really adds up to something.
Possibly just creepiness.
Maybe it's a combination of the Astapori are trying to burrow in, and the dragons are trying to burrow out, and they're going to meet somewhere in the middle, and then that's going to be the dragon's way to exit. Yeah. Because, can we all agree that it'll be like
a hill where they're running in and out of different doors.
It's like Scooby-Doo. Yeah, exactly. The dragons are chasing the guy. Exactly.
Perfect. If that had actually been season 8 of the show, it would have been better. I would have
been. No show talk.
No. Yeah, yeah. We're saving show talk until the very end.
I would pay money to hear the Benny Hill theme played with like lute and violin, though. That would be amazing.
It's not a spoiler that it was shit, all right?
Right.
Jed, get on that. It's your lute out.
Yeah, Jed. Oh my God.
Is your call to arms?
Is this when. So this definitely sparks Quentin off, and he's like, he gets dragon lust, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think so. What about this visit was like, hey, you know what I should do?
Right.
I should go kill myself.
Get me one of them terrifying hell monsters all by myself, even though she says that she's afraid of them too.
Yeah. He's such a timid guy as well. It doesn't really fit.
But she kind of... like, she doesn't exactly suggest anything to him, but she's like, well, you cannot marry me, but, you know, I have 3 dragons and I can only ride one. So what should he have understood by that?
Yeah, I think it's more like, are any of you guys gun owners? Like, you ever go to someone's house?
Oh, yeah, mate, I've got loads.
I live in Australia.
They're illegal over here.
How progressive. In America, we love guns.
perhaps you've heard.
Like, I remember, like, being a kid and having my buddy show me his, like, father's, like, rifle cabinet where he had all the shotguns and rifles and shit like that. And I think it's like that. You just, like, show them the 2 dragons and all of a sudden it's like, I didn't know these existed. I didn't know what they looked like, but I kind of want to play with them.
I took it as sort of as Daenerys saying, this is real. You're here with the idea of war and my hand in marriage, but this comes with a package. Are you sure you want to get involved with all this?
I don't know. I thought it was like Daenerys getting her dick out basically and being like, you want to fuck with this?
Jesus. Is that why she flushed?
Thank you for that bumper.
Yeah, I do think it was like I think she has a very like kind of condescending attitude towards him just in general. And she showed him because she was like, look, you know, kid, this is the reality of it. Like, you don't have a chance here. And maybe I'll come help you out when I've got this shit sorted. But like, you don't really have a part to play here. Although I do think that she was like tempting him by pointing out that she had extras essentially, but I don't think that she did it with the intention of being like, hey, you know who would be a good dragon rider? This guy.
Well, she tells him, you know, you need to get away from here. Dario's pissed off. My husband's probably going to go after you. This isn't a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
And Quinton's like, nah, that's cool.
Yeah. And she thinks to herself, like, you're going to die here, Sir Frog. And what happens?
He gets toasted.
Do you feel like George Stop.
like mirrored Quentin and Fionn a little bit, like with their familial obligations and the lengths they're willing to go to serve their fathers.
No. I mean, I think not it's really. A common theme throughout the books that, you know, his family, and, you know, the sigils and everything else, like, the, you know, Jamie deals with it a lot. Like, you know, when he says his, you know, they make you swear so many oaths and you have to break one of them. I think it's a overarching theme throughout all the books. I don't think it's just specific to Theon or Quinn.
Oh, no, I meant specifically the reckless behavior to and going rogue to, like, appease their fathers and get more of, you know, a leeway with them.
I don't think so, but
I just Quentin is just—he's such a. There's just nothing about him that
like he doesn't want to go empty-handed, and Theon goes rogue to prove like, well, I'm not fucking Stark. You know what I mean? Like,
I say it's a sunken cost fallacy where they each keep doubling down on whatever they've got. Theon refuses to leave Winterfell. Quentin's refusing to get out of Marine.
They've both gone too far. But I would still say Quentin is, he still in his mind is doing the right thing. Whereas I think, obviously, Theon, he gets to the end and is disgusted with himself.
He's consumed by his ego.
I think it also...
Yeah. But no, I don't think he is, because he realizes he's fucked. Like, if he was consumed with his ego, he would have still thought, like... I guess, and he does kind of think about joining the Black, but, like, he'd think that he would be able to conquer, like, I don't know. I think he just realizes that he's fucked, and that kind of gives away the fact that it's not completely ego-driven. Like, there's some rationale to him.
This is Theon.
Because he's fucked, he lets his ego fly off the handle, and when he goes to parlay with Sir Roderick... He just, like, spouts out all this shit that allegedly he's been bottling up because the Starks were so horrible to him and treated him respectfully and blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, he is, definitely. No, you know, don't feel too sorry for Theon.
Well, and I think now that we're talking about this, it is interesting, the two Dany chapters that we're reading, the only chapter that's in between is Theon's first chapter when he regains his name. So that could have some, I mean, it, just as far as like, you know, themes in the book and reading it, that could have something to do with it. Comparing the two chapters at least.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. That contrast is really like apparent in this to me.
Right. It's
just so sad because like, I feel like Doran would just rather have him back. Whereas Balon could literally not give less of a fuck.
Yeah, but I guess with both sons, they're so wanting to appease their father, both of them do some stupid shit to try to do that, and both of them end up completely fucked at the end, so.
Or do this.
A story filled with daddy issues.
Right. I wondered so what Quentin had told her.
With his dad.
Well, sorry,
and women.
What?
Do you feel like George has a good relationship with his dad?
Oh, God. I don't know him well.
I've never heard of him talk about his parents.
You know, let me shoot a text to him. I'm going to ask.
Yeah. You get along with your dad?
Yeah. Daddy issues, question mark?
So, according to his Finding Your Roots episode, his father didn't know how to save any money and was, like, ridiculous and would have, like, he'd go into the city to party and have a taxi cab drive behind his taxi cab just to make sure that they know the way to the club he's going to. So I think he probably did have some little bit of issues with him, but I don't think anything that would have completely influenced this book. But
I don't know. That sounds like Tywin's dad.
Yeah,
yeah,
Tywin's
right. Yeah.
I mean, look, I'm not a huge fan of like authorial autobiographical criticism, but I think if we take a step back and just think about it in terms of the context of the book, I think that daddy issues would have to be part and parcel with any system that's heavily patriarchal and also based on primogeniture, right? Because anything that the father establishes is legally, socioculturally, automatically becomes the responsibility of the firstborn son, right? So good or bad. I mean, I think it's systemic in addition to...
It's an easy conflict to write to, like any parental issues.
Steven that Spielberg loves it. That's
a writer, an easy tool to pull out to.
Alrighty.
Alright.
Let's get to the state.
Yeah.
Dracarys.
How many years has it been this is going on now?
The reread?
Yeah.
Or the wait.
No, I think the reread, like, probably...
5 years.
3.5... Four years, yeah.
Wow. It's been at least five. Four. Because...
Yeah.
Five, because I moved twice out of an old apartment in with my fiancé, and then we bought a house about 3 years ago.
Hmm. I was in Edinburgh when I started listening, and I had maybe 20 or so episodes to catch up on. So, yeah.
So what's the over-under then? Who's going for nearest date gets it? Because I know the date the first one was published.
June 2014.
Oh, I'll say Feb 2015.
Mary?
Oh, I don't know. I think Noah is closer.
I think... July 2015.
Are you on the internets?
No.
it's August 31st, 2015. Ah, yes. Episode wow. one.
Wow.
Oh my God.
So say for 4 years old.
Jesus.
Oh, I'd be going to nursery if it was a kid.
Wait a minute, what year is this? 2019?
Yeah.
Yes, Matt. I mean, yeah, for now. Yeah.
Fock 232, if you want to do an episode. Panspermia. Okay, The Great Linear Song of Ice and Fire Reread Part 1. Hosts were Bina, Amanda, Middle Cyclone. I miss Amanda. Come back, Amanda. Nadia Vali, White Raven. And we had Jodo Whiteheart with a song. And we did a lot of chapters as well. We did like 4 chapters, I think. So, yeah.
Yeah, I remember on my porch.
Wow. I mean, we bought Brett at B-Day. A lot has happened. But we are nearly at the end, right? I mean, there are only 105 episodes, so we're getting there.
Yes, we're doing this T-Wow chapter, and my first one was a Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Jeez. And we will definitely finish in 2020, so.
Yeah.
For sure.
For sure.
Could save the last one for next Christmas, just in case.
No book has come out by
then. I was going to say, I think we've already stretched it as far as we can.
Yeah.
We're going to slow down a little bit more now, listeners, okay? So just look out for an episode every 6 months.
We're going on strike until The Winds of Winter is released.
Dracarys.
Summary.
Yeah, I'm gonna make you guys regret this.
That's alright.
Is it not short or not funny?
It's just not a great chapter. Yeah. I was tempted by Westeros.org summary, which was Arianne travels through the Rainwood to the Mistwood and Griffin's Roost. That's it.
Wait, the end. Wait, is this the chapter?
Is that it?
Guys. I've written something.
That, I don't want to put my foot in, but I think there's a chapter before where Arianne travels and meets the Tollens in Dawn.
Yeah, I thought that's the one that we were...
Yeah, that might...
She's not in the cave this time.
Is it Arianne 1 or Arianne 2?
Oh my God, Noah, you spent so much time on that. I can't believe you did the wrong...
Oh, fuck,
that's heartbreaking.
Me. I've actually got a little thing about it. Oh, someone's going to have to edit this out.
Damn it!
No, keep it in. We want to shame Noah.
Yeah, I thought it was when she went to...
I thought we'd already done that.
Well, lucky for all of us, I have a recap. Also. Oh,
what?
No, you're just going to wing one.
Extra credit.
No, I'm
going to
read off the Westeros.org.
Oh.